I am Plant Online. This is thecommentary.ca. The Globe and Mail's Deirdre Kelly joins me now. She's the author of a new memoir, her first book, Paris Times 8, Finding Myself in the City of Dreams. It's a delightful memoir about her many trips to Paris, France. She talks about what her visits meant in terms of how she viewed her life and how it subsequently shaped them. She first traveled to Paris 30 years ago, and 8 times since she's gone back under different circumstances, each interesting and introspective. Deirdre Kelly is a features writer at the Globe and Mail and was an award-winning dance critic and fashion columnist there. This book is published by Greystone. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Toronto, Deirdre Kelly. Good morning, Ms. Kelly.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
No one's ever said that, so that's
kind of really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, my publisher is in Vancouver. I've been wanting to do something that's Vancouver related, so
yeah.
For me, I was thrilled that you wanted to talk with me.
And
so
it's
thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. It's a great book, by the way.
I am so happy to hear you say that because it's funny. I've seen a couple of little write-ups. Oh, and men may like this too. So I'm happy that a man is, you know, I think there's a mistake that it might be a woman's book, but I hope it's a humanistic book.
Yeah, well, what struck me about it, because I've never been to Paris.
Wow.
So this was an interesting view onto it. Growing up, what were your initial ideas of Paris?
Oh, that is a great way to start because I actually was, I was a brownie,
yeah.
and you know, one had to get badges, and I remember very diligently wanting to get my travel badge, not being able to travel much as a young person. You know, I didn't have my own money then, and I do remember creating a scrapbook of beautiful and exotic places, and guess which city figured prominently in my scrapbook? It was Paris. So I guess at that time that it was something very beautiful, very much a city of the imagination even then.
And it's on the back of the book, you've got a quote from Richard Florida, who we've had on the program. And
he's a wonderful man.
Yeah, and I'll read it because I think it's instructive
of what
this book is about. Witty and candid, this book reveals how cities are as much creations of the imagination as they are constructs of steel, stone, and glass. The imagination, your imagination that you'd had about Paris, once you got there, was it myth, really, rather than what you'd thought of growing up, perhaps?
I would say that was, well, I think I do explore that in my first chapter, for instance. You know, when I'm riding in the car and I've just come off the plane for the very first time, I'm on for real French soil, and it's like, oh my God, it's the Eiffel Tower, you know, these iconic landmarks that you grow up with and are part of, I guess, the collective imagination, if I may say. And so there was a kind of, I guess, coming face to face with the iconography, the mythology of Paris. And I think what I try to explore throughout the book is that sometimes my head is too much up in the clouds, and that I do trip over some of the cliches that many of us may hold dear about Paris, because while it is a beautiful, charming, seductive city, it isn't a city that I always found readily embracing of me. And perhaps that's maybe one of the one of the myths, that, you know, that it's la vie boheme all the time. In France, or in Paris, I should say specifically. But in my case, I think that there are lots of, real life challenges about that city, and that really came to the fore, especially when I finally did get to work there as a fashion reporter, and it was almost nigh impossible to get the job done in a way that I was used to.
Now, why isn't Paris readily embracing? Is it the people? Is it the culture? Is it just the way the city's perhaps?
You know, I actually won't even go into, you know, that whole stereotype about the French people, because I'm not bilingual,
yeah.
And that's maybe even, I hope, is sort of one of the glosses I put on this journey. It's sort of an expat story with a difference in that, you know, I don't really fluently speak the language, so therefore I never really had a relationship with the people. It's always a relationship with the city.
Now, what,
why is it forbidding? I think it's because, in large ways, maybe it is a city that is very layered. It has meaning that goes just beyond it being a place. It has, every revolution perhaps known to Western civilization has been hatched there, for instance. So there's these ideas that I think present themselves to you, and then it's a matter of trying to get inside them, and it's not always easy to get inside them. I'm thinking that Paris, it's very protective, perhaps, of what it has, what it is, and it doesn't allow just anybody to enter the inner circle. And that said, I think, so you might think, well, then why the heck do you keep going back? You know, it's almost masochistic to keep going back to a city that frequently has kept me at arm's length. But I think for me, it sort of is more the challenge of wanting to aspire to maybe the wonders that Paris has. And for me, it becomes a quest for an ideal.
Now, throughout the book, you talk about gaining this deeper understanding of yourself. What did you learn in Paris that you couldn't have uncovered about yourself had you lived, I don't know, say, in Moscow or Milwaukee?
Well, gee, I don't know about if I can talk about other cities, but maybe I could just talk even about my own city, which is Toronto.
Yeah.
And I think, see, this is maybe sort of the germ of the idea of the book. It's that one day when I sort of thinking about how many times I'd gone to Paris, and it even astonished me that I had gone so many times over matter of years. And I was able to see myself as if set in amber from each time that I went. It was almost like there was speaking of the imagination, it's almost like my imagination had taken a photograph of me at a particular time at that particular place. And I think it's because Paris was always the other. It's always the city beyond my everyday, and that's why I call it the city of dream in a way. I think it was a place where I could start to see myself evolve over the years, and where I could see myself, as I said, much more clearly than in my everyday existence here in Toronto. And I think Paris for me then became like a measuring stick or even a mirror of my development.
And in
ways that, I don't think I could see it as much, as clearly here in Toronto, where it's just, the quotidian detail.
Yeah.
Sort of, it blurs, your existence is blurred one day to the next day.
And it also shapes your life, I guess. It influences the choices one makes, I suppose, having been there.
Well, it certainly did with me, and it's sort of wide-ranging. It can be maybe on a superficial level, of wanting to dress well.
Yeah.
When I've been there, it is true what I wrote, sort of this, you're in awe of the Parisienne, which is sort of this, what they call the Parisian woman of rare breed. And she is a woman of indescribable and famous style. And I found myself wanting to emulate that. So even superficially, I've tried to bring that back to Toronto, and I'd open my closet and think, I'm dressing, at that standard. It also taught me how to set a table. It taught me how to, perhaps wear eyeliner. But more fundamentally, I found that what really always has enchanted me about Paris is that it is a city for the people. It is a city designed with public spaces and that are beautiful. I also like that there's a social element in Paris that, for me was very exciting to experience when I would go to the cafes and when I used to stay, crashing at people's friends' apartments, and we would have these impromptu cocktail parties or coffee sessions, and it would always be talk and interacting. And I tried to bring that back with me into my everyday life, that is, establish a real sense of community with like-minded people and to reach out. So I think that is very much a strong influence that Paris has had on my life.
You also refer to Paris in the book as your other mother. What was your real mom like growing up?
Well, if you read the book, it's...
Yeah. Well, give people listening to us a bit of a taste of her.
Well, I have to be respectful because my mother is still very much alive and kicking.
Yeah.
And, but I suppose to say it was a difficult or tough upbringing in the sense that my mom is difficult and tough. She is, however, a very proud woman. She isn't as educated as I, and she made sure that I was very educated, so I owe that to her. She left school at 14. She's Scottish. She's an immigrant to Canada. She is a single mom from the get-go, in a way like a prototypical feminist, really. So I always grew up with this influence of a very strong woman. But that said, she didn't value some of the things that I value, that is art and beauty and, you know, maybe refined living and life. My mother's rather rough around the edges, very abrasive at times. And, in fact, I think that's probably why I chose a city as foreign and as remote from anything I knew growing up as Paris. It is also, I believe, after now writing the book and I'm starting to make all these connections, why the heck do I love ballet? Why did I become a dance critic, of all things, something that's, again, so rarefied and so idealized? I really always wanted to escape what I felt the chafing confines of my own upbringing. And, as I say, Paris was one escape route.
Now, you took your mom to Paris at one point?
Yes, I did. And it's for, and excuse me if I sound overcritical of my mother, I don't mean to be, but yes, she's a tough mom, but at the same time, she's the only mom I have. And actually, my whole life, I've always wanted to share with her. I think it's been a quest to get her to love me in a way that I could understand and in a way that maybe was unconditional. And so all my life, I've always, if I discovered something, the first person I always wanted to share it with was my mother. So, of course, Paris being so dear to me, I always did want to share it with her. She'd never been to the continent before. And in fact, she grew up in a community in Scotland that would be suspicious of anything, you know, any culture that wasn't English-speaking. But at one point, I was able to convince her to come with me. And I thought that by going there, she would love what I love and, in turn, would therefore love me. And it didn't quite turn out that way. It was a very explosive time in Paris, quite literally, because I couldn't have planned this, but and then in the writing of it, couldn't have planned it even better. But the backdrop to that trip was literally terrorist bombs going off in the streets of Paris while she and I were hurling verbal grenades at each other in our tiny Left Bank hotel room. And at one point, I'm sleeping in the bathtub trying to get away from her. And anyway, you know, it kind of brought to the fore that we are different women. She is who she is. I am who I am. And maybe even Paris, that was very evident. I mean, she wanted to walk down the Champs-Élysées singing April in Paris with a wiggle in her walk. And I was just so much more pedantic and, you know, wanting to make sure we had the proper Paris experience. You know, mother, no, you don't do this. You look at this, and you don't say it like this. You say it like that. Sort of a role reversal in a sense. And interesting, though, I recall this trip as being very strained, but my mother does recollect it as being a very fond time. So it just, again, goes to show how, you know, memory can be very subjective.
Yeah.
And she was also very forgiving in a way of my my bossiness over her at that time. And I remember she did say something quite endearing to me. You know, well, darling daughter, I just knew you wanted it to be all right. I knew you just wanted us to be worthy. So maybe she has more insight into me than I allow.
People have to read this book for some of the stories that you tell about that. Well, what did Paris mean to your husband and your children?
Well, I wish they could take the phone right now and tell you themselves, but I know that my husband loved it. And like you, he had never been to Paris before, so immediately upon him proposing to me, I bought 2 tickets to Paris, and in a way, it was kind of furtive of me. It was a litmus test. You know, I had to see, is he really the one? How is he going to react to a city that means so much to me? And, okay, 14 years later, I can say, tell you, he passed the test. But I know that he loved it. He loved it in ways that, again, that was very maybe personal to him, because his own father had found refuge in Paris as an escapee from communism in Yugoslavia, for instance. And so it was interesting to walk through this, some of the same streets that I had walked many times before I actually took him there, and to have him reflect on different feelings that he was having about Paris, because it was making him think of himself and his own roots and his own past and his own longings. So that, I think, was, you know, was very beautiful, and I do write about that in one of the chapters. And my own children, I'm happy to say, and that's in the last chapter called Mother, I take them, and didn't they say the right thing one day when they go, Mommy, Mommy, don't you just wish we could live here? And then they added, but of course, with their grandmother there and their father there and all the all the people that matter, then Paris would be truly utopia on earth.
In all of your visits there, how long was it, the longest that you were there?
You know, I think it was the very first trip when I was 19 years of age. And that's the trip I did. That was, in a way, by chance. I was invited by a Canadian family. I actually, sort of going back to the mother question, maybe your listeners will now intuit how difficult it was growing up with my mother. I left home at age 17. I sort of the only first chance I could get, but I had been plotting it for years. And I moved in with a Canadian family here in Toronto, and I took care of their children. And at one point, the gentleman of the home, he had an opportunity to go on sabbatical in Paris, and it was sort of a scouting trip, and they asked me to come and be part of the family. And so I got to live with them in Paris pretty swankily, I must add. I mean, it wasn't bad for my first time. I know you haven't been there, but it was on the left bank, the Rive Gauche, which is a very, very exciting part of Paris, right in Saint-Germain-des-Prés, and really opposite the Louvre Museum. And I lived on a very aristocratic apartment that had been left vacant by the Parisians who went south for the summer. So it was all, as I said, very chichi. And I was there for almost 2 months, and I got to learn all about Paris in a way intimately at that time. And I used Hemingway's A Movable Feast as my Michelin guide, or my map. I kind of traced his steps through Paris, and so in a way, perhaps I was perpetuating a myth at that time, but it was a wonderful experience. Despite the fact that the family, in a way, it was kind of not what they had said it would be. It wasn't necessarily be part of the family. I was more like Cinderella.
Yeah. Now, in all of your visits there, had you, actually in the 30 years since, had you ever seriously thought of it living there permanently?
Oh, that was the whole plan.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is what I'm saying. It's sort of like dream interrupted.
Yeah.
That could have been the subtext, actually, of the story. And, geez, wish I'd thought of that. Because what happened, as I mentioned, I went to Paris that first time. I had dreamed of it since childhood. And then when I was there, I was astonished to find a place on earth that was so physically beautiful and that did value art in the way that I, a young teenager then, you know, art for me was my beacon, and it was my everything. And I'm just going to say, I you say you haven't been, so excuse me for saying things to maybe to some of your listeners who have been in Paris. But for instance, in Paris, almost on every street corner of a building, there's a plaque that will commemorate a genius of the past who's slept there, ate there, you know, born there, anybody who's come before. So you're constantly aware of sort of the mighty, you know, the mighty and mightiness of Paris. And that was truly, truly intoxicating for me. And so I thought, this is my home. This is my spiritual, artistic home. I'm going to come back. But I was then just on the cusp of going to university for the first time, so I had to come back to Toronto. I was a scholarship student at U of T, University of Toronto, got my degree, and in fact, I was so certain I was going to live in Paris at the end of my undergraduate years that I, at one point, dropped French, which was a tough study at the university level, just thinking, oh, well, I'm going to become bilingual as soon as I move there in, what is it now, 2 years' time. And that actually is the context of the second chapter, Wannabe, where I want to be Parisian. I want to be the next Ernest Hemingway. And I live at Shakespeare and Company, a fabled bookstore opposite Notre Dame now. And again, I'm positive I'm going to stay. And then life intervenes, I suppose. My mother insists I come back, and I very much did listen to her because she convinced me. I had just gotten a scholarship to graduate school. And she convinced me that, you know, just do it the 1 year because you'll never have this chance again. And I kind of thought that, yeah, that life would just take off in Paris and I would never go back to my studies. So I go back to Toronto to do the graduate year. And lo and behold, I got hired right out of U of T by the Globe and Mail. So that's what I mean. It's dream interrupted. Now that, you know, I've got the plum job right from the get-go. So Paris becomes, as I said, it becomes the desire, because it's no longer the place I can actually just pick up and move to. And it's interesting. I think by the end of even writing the book, and especially going there with my children, who very much grounded me in the moment, you know, as children will do, they made me realize that, you know, Paris is there, and it will always be there for me. And I think I'm now more at a point where I don't have to live there anymore because I carry it with me in my heart, in my mind, in my imagination. It's become a part of me.
And in this book, yeah. Are you thinking of going back anytime soon?
Yeah, budget allowing.
Yeah.
It's always now a matter of money.
Yeah.
And I would go anytime. Are you kidding? But I'm just a lowly journalist and with two children,
yeah.
Piano lessons and art lessons and ballet lessons, and that's sort of taking precedence right now.
So it's
I've read all the Paris literature.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a place you'd recommend people like me to go to?
Of course. I think that's what I mean. I'm always astonished when I hear someone hasn't been. It's a must visit, a must experience, because there's nothing like it on earth. You will be just, I think, blown away by the shape of the buildings, the design of the streets, the harmonic proportions. You would love, well, I love this as a teenager, you know, the fact of going into a subway and there are sculptures in it, and everything's created for the, as I said, for the people, for the pleasure of the human mind, and I think you won't be the same after tasting it.
Yeah, Deirdre, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and
thank you so much.
And congratulations, and continued good luck with the book.
Oh, well, thank you very, very much.
You're very welcome. The book is called Paris Times 8, Finding Myself in the City of Dreams. Do pick it up. It's just a fascinating book, and if you're like me and haven't been yet, it's a good way to get into it. It's published by Greystone. It's author Deirdre Kelly on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.